Blog Talk Radio. I'd like to welcome everyone to John Talk Radio tonight. This is our Saturday night special, 25th February. My special guest tonight is John Fallon. John, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
It's really good to have you on.
I'm always here.
And I'm always here. So it's really good that we can get connected. It's awesome. I really appreciate you coming on. And it's great to have – this is part three of our interview series with you. And I think it's one thing I wanted to start off with a little bit, John, if we could, a little background on the steps. And for people that are maybe listening that need a little brush up on the band and when they started and who was in the band, if you'd like to start off with that, that would be good.
Right. Well, originally started really with my brother David and myself, and we put together a group basically when we were in Los Angeles called the Blue Max, which is M-A-C-S, sort of like a parody on your raincoat and the German World War One flying metal. So it was sort of basically we put together a mod group. I played guitar and sang, and Dave played bass, sang, and we had a drummer from Chicago, Flood, named Eddie Gribb, and we recorded a 5-track EP in L.A. and had it pressed in Chicago. And, you know, that's how it started, but, you know, we were still based in L.A. and Eddie was in Chicago. So at that point, I think Dave and I, we went over back to Ireland and were trying to do something, like trying to get something going in Dublin. And it's funny enough, we got a letter from some people at two different record companies in Los Angeles saying, if you're ever in town, I want to put you in the studio. And it was funny, well, let's call their bluff because our parents were living there at the time. So we just said, okay, screw all this, get on the plane, go back there and get in the studio.
That's funny. That's always how it works, isn't it? You're right there, nothing happens, you go to Ireland, and it's like, hey, you guys stop by.
But it was funny, it worked for us both levels, because we when we were in Dublin, I sent out loads of tapes to England, and I got a letter from Paul Weller, The Jam.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and he was just saying, like, you guys, you know, in other words, The Jam were just over, and he was off kind of doing something else, like with the beginning of the Style Council and that girl Tracy was singing or whatever. But, he just thought we had pretty good songwriting, and he wished us all the best, you know, get back to him in the future, which, you know, we never did. But also, we got a great review in Melody Maker, because they said that, like, it was the top tape of the week or whatever, or the month that was sent to them, and they went on about the songwriting aspects of the band. So we were armed with that when we went back to Los Angeles.
Oh, that's cool.
So we walked in the door saying, well, Melody Maker already thinks we're good.
And here's the proof, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes people need to be told you're good.
that's funny. What year was that, John?
That was 83.
And that's interesting, too, because to me, what was like the popular music at that time? What was like, I can remember, let's see, 83. It had to be...
Total shite. It was like Culture Club and The Jam had just ended in 82.
Yeah.
And it's funny enough, The Who had broken up in 82. You know, I know they keep coming back through the years, but that was when they had officially broke it up. And everything seemed to be kind of running out of gas. It was just kind of a lot of... But you know what? It was very 80s at that point. Like, you look at... We were in Britain, and at the top, say, the top 30, it just completely trash for the most part.
Men at Work, weren't they big at that?
Ooh, weren't they good?
Men at Work.
Men without hats.
Yeah, they were at work without their hats.
Men without lunch.
Oh, that's funny. And I kind of remember that there was different types of genre of music. So I think it's interesting, at that point, you guys were coming around in 83 with this sound, this heavier kind of sound. And did you have trouble with the record companies with that? Because a lot of times, you know, you and I have talked in the past about this. It doesn't always – good music and good songwriting doesn't always translate
no.
to what the record companies want.
Well, you know what? We did learn a lesson. There were some guys, in fairness, in the A&R departments in Hollywood that actually did like us. And okay, David Kahn, he's a producer. Actually, he did the Bangles.
Okay.
And he actually was quite interested. He actually came to a couple of our shows. But, again, he had already signed the Bangles, and he had two other signings of people, you know, we never remember. But you're only allowed two or three signings a year. So, you know, the years drift. So, you know, we couldn't get signed that year because, say, the Bangles got signed the year before, and then there was, like, two other groups he signed or so, some other act. And then there was a guy named Ron Fair. He actually, we worked with him in 83 when we went back. And he really wasn't up on a lot of the music. He could tell we were good, but he didn't know what to do with us. So he took us into the studio for that. He produced the A side of the Mystic Records.
Okay.
There were four tracks on that. He produced those. And then we shopped around, and we almost got several deals, but it never actually happened. You know, nobody opened the wallet. But, you know, again, one or two of them actually did really want to sign us, but they were already done for the year. You know, if you do your three signings by May, you know, you're out of it for the rest of the year. You've got to make sure that those three signings get in the studio, follow the budget, you know, do all the promo crap, do the tour, and see if they can get anywhere. So he was already, you know, Tom was already too busy.
Yeah, I wonder what the odds, John, of those bands making it when they sign those three. You know what I mean? How what the odds of are one of those bands making it?
Well, it worked because the Bengals did.
They did, yes,
yeah,
they did.
So, you know, the other two didn't. So.
Yep. So that's one out of three. But I guess that's not too bad. But you know, when you guys, it's interesting to me. So you're out there playing your butts off, and you're doing the clubs, and you're doing what you have to do, but you still have to make this transition to the music scene, to the industry, so to speak, right? And I think that's where the translation to me gets a little murky, because they will look at music that I could, as Joe Listener, could, wow, I'll buy that, but they have to market it, and they have to look at it from their business side, and they have to get the suits to stamp it. So what did you guys learn at that point? I mean, from that, obviously you stayed true to your music and true to your sound. And I think
that's why we're such a household name worldwide.
Well,
uh-huh.
if you look at some of the bands that, you know, we mentioned a couple earlier, that I don't know how certain bands made it. So it's always, it's like this mystery to me of how, you know, how a guy can sign a band, I don't know, you know, that can make all this money. And I could name a couple that's present company in today's world that one of my kids will say, look at this band. It's, you know, these guys are making millions of dollars, and I honestly, the God can't figure that out.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's cool that the listeners can now... And we were talking a little bit earlier, John, about how you got contacted by this person who had been in one of your gigs when he was 18.
It's interesting, too, is because so many years now have gone by that when the Steps were in their heyday of touring, which was, say, 88, 89, touring Europe, I mean, we did 70-something shows those 2 years. So we covered a lot of Europe. And at the end of it, in 89, we went back to London to do the Harps and Hammers album. And as in the process of doing that, we stayed a month. So we did a few shows, and the big one was the Freak Beat Freak Out. It was December 29th, 89. And it was at the Fulham, it was in Fulham at the Greyhound. And Richard Allen, our manager, had put this together, and we played with the Bevis Frond and the Chemistry set. And it was packed. I mean, it was like a show from 1967.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I mean, finally, at least some of the bigger magazines copped on to it. Like, we got a review in Q magazine at that time. You know, they had to kind of acknowledge it because there was just hundreds and hundreds of people packed in that place. And one of the guys that was there was a guy named John Mills, who now is the editor of Shindig magazine, which is a really nice glossy magazine. So it's kind of cool when he's 18 and sees us doing it. Now he's, you know, much older, and he's got a magazine.
Yep.
And he just got in touch with me today and gave me his address and, you know, sent me the single. I want to review it.
Oh, that's great. And have you ever, I was thinking about this too. You said you played with a Chemistry set, and do you ever contact those guys? Do you ever talk to any of the bands that you played with back then?
Well, I contacted the Chemistry set through MySpace, which is kind of intelligible, trying to get through there, you know, but I did connect with a couple of them. They're in Spain now, for the most part. They live in Spain, and they play down there. So I'm not sure exactly what they're doing. They're still doing some sort of psychedelic-based music, but I don't know if they have a drummer anymore.
Huh. Yeah, I just wondered how that was. I mean, if you ever think about what these guys are doing and try to reach out to them, because it's got to be, you know, kind of cool to have people that play the same type of music and have the same type of goals and things like that. So.
Right. I mean, I was in touch with Nick Solomon, who is the Bevis Frond, and he actually was in the recording studio, the same studio we did two albums in London. He recommended that place.
Yeah.
Well, he was back in the studio again, so in some ways it looks like nothing's changed. It was just like there was a lull there of about 15 years, and then we can go pick it up.
Now you're back at it. That's awesome. And another thing I think is interesting, because I can remember shows, you know, in this area, and I've just got interested in poster art, you know, of the bands. Did you guys ever get into that pretty good? I mean, I think that was something that's missing today, because I can remember going into Columbus, which isn't too far from here, and seeing the posters for bands that were going to be in town. And the art of the posters were so cool. And did you guys, as the Steps, did you ever use any...
actually, other people did for us. I mean, when we toured Italy, there was posters for all the gigs. And some of them were, like, really big, like 6-foot by 4-foot posters that were put up. And I have one copy of one of them. But,
oh, that's cool.
And there's other ones, too. I love the fact, you know, when they're using English and they don't understand it. So, like, this says, The Steps, Chicks, Guitars, Cool, Swinging. You know, whatever. And I go, well, you know, it's good enough for me.
That's funny. That's pretty cool. That's got to be awesome to have that poster, though, because... It just, to me, I think, you know, you look at them and you just get this feeling. It's like we talked in the other shows, John, about the album art and how that, you know, to me, getting the album in my hand and being able to see and look at the artwork on the front of the albums and reading about it was so cool, and I think that's kind of missing. But I do think it's happening again where, you know, some of the other bands, younger bands now are starting to do that. And that's why I mentioned about the artwork and the posters. And
right.
Yeah, because I think it's just one of the cooler things.
You know what's easy to do it now? Because all you got to do is do it online. And you create a poster and stick it up on your Facebook page and everything. And so people see it as a poster. For example, today, my son's doing a gig down on the Strip. And there's going to be a load of bands playing. And they, you know, there's a poster made for it. And I don't know whether they print them out. But, you know, let's face it, they can print out tickets that look very professional. They got posters that are professional. Years ago, everything was half-assed and, you know, photocopied.
Yep. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, that's cool. I guess it'd be good if you wanted to talk about your son's band a little bit. I mean, just to...
Well, why not? Listeners. I mean, okay, what we're trying to do here is they're basically a mod sort of indie kind of lo-fi band, a kind
okay.
of three combo, and... finally, there's some bands that they're able to play with that are actually, I think, pretty good. Like, there's a group, I'll read the ticket right now. It's called The Debonairs, The Revivers, and a group that he has played with more is The Remedies, and another group called Everyone Meltdown. These groups are more like ska and mod. And
okay.
Finally, there's like a whole show tonight starting at 6, going all the way for hours. And it's right, you know, just north of the Sahara and the Strip. So it's right down, you know, right in the heart of everything.
Now, does Dad give his son words of encouragement and suggestions and things like that with the band, or
and some criticism? But you know, again, they're doing their own thing, and if it wasn't very good, I'd tell them, frankly.
Yeah, in a nice way. Yeah, Well, that's cool. But and it's got to be kind of neat to see your son following in the musical footsteps. Do you have words of? Do you sometimes think, oh no, don't do that, or go in?
I mean, what it is that he's developed a taste for doing it. He's got a couple of cool guitars. He's got the right attitude with the clothes, and the other guys are coming along really well. And I don't know, when you're 18, you might as well have some fun doing it.
Yeah, that's true. Do you get up in the front row and start doing the mosh pit with them and stuff like that, John?
No, I just do gigantic backflips with holding a glass of whiskey.
You got to put that on now. I'll watch that. Well, that's cool. What we wanted to do in this last, you know, the third part of the interview was kind of go through the songs that we have, and we thought it would be kind of neat to talk about the production of the songs, and maybe if we could talk a little bit about the one we started off with, Chicago Oratorio.
Okay, that album that's from the Godsmen and Ghosts album that was recorded in 1995 and released in 1997, and that was on Delirium Records out of London, and that was recorded in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it was done there because we knew a guy, well, there was a group called Plastikland I was friends with, and the bass player, John Frankovic, was hired as our producer on this one, which is kind of fun, where we, you know, because usually it's the the band we produce ourselves. We have some great engineers, but we actually, you know, sit down at the board and pick the sounds and everything like that. So we did a little of that with this, but really the mixing and all that was left for Frankovic to do, and then he'd, you know, send it to us, what do you think? So that was different. This never happened to us before. And it was interesting. We go, I think we had some rehearsals down in the Chicago area, because I was, you know, I was living there, and David was living in Ireland, and the other two guys were in California and Oregon. So what we did is we met there in Chicago, rehearsed a bit, went straight up to Wisconsin and started recording. And we walk into the studio, and right in the middle of the studio is a big keg of beer.
There you go.
Welcome to Milwaukee.
Yeah. Really?
Start drinking and start recording.
Yeah, in that order.
And, of course, that's what we did. So.
And
I mean, it was empty when we left, so...
Yeah, that's always, that's funny how that works out like that. But that is a drinking town. There's a lot of that. So did you have any problem turning that over to the producer? And I say that because if you had the realm, or you were holding the reins in the other albums, and then you're going to say, okay, we're going to trust you to do this. Was there any difficulty in doing that, John?
Well, yeah, of course there was. Because, you know, you have a vision of what it should sound like. And some songs kind of write themselves and almost produce themselves. You know, they're done a certain way, and there's not much you can do with them. And basically, my view, just screw them up. So if they're done a certain way, most of them are going to come out okay. I would say some of the songs I would have changed bits and pieces. But on the whole, I really have nothing to complain about. And I agree with this particular song, Chicago Oratorio, which is like three or four songs smashed into one.
Okay.
It's sort of like my influence on that song is like the intro. That's kind of like a Paul Weller influence at the beginning. Even though a lot of people aren't going to pick that up, it's just the guitars, the smashing of the banging away on that. But then it kind of switches into kind of an Abbey Road gear. And funny enough, that song from the beginning to the end was recorded straight through.
Like, wow.
Guitar. The drums, the bass, and the two guitars were all recorded live in the studio. The only thing I did after was do the vocals with Dave and the acoustic. But the whole thing was done live, and you'd listen to that, you would swear it was one of those overdub songs. You know, where you could, because the timing is all different. Jim Bailey and I just keep eye contact, and as long as we keep an eye contact, it'll work. You can just play anything at any tempo.
Wow.
You know, here's where the change is going to go, I mean, that'll be like, say, that particular song is mine, that's why that worked. Or if it was Dave's song, he'd be maintaining the eye contact, and we'd be following. You know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah, that's amazing. Did you do it in one take?
Probably a couple of takes. I mean, I can't remember how many. But, I mean, we did 14 songs, and we weren't really there that long, say a week. And that's kind of a lot to do. I mean, normally we do 10 songs, and it takes weeks and weeks to get it right.
Right.
This was hell bent for leather, I bet.
Now, were you when you came into the studio to do this? What was your goal? What was your mindset coming in? Because you guys had not played together for a little while. Is that correct?
Yeah. Because the last time we were together in the studio was the beginning of '91. Oh no, sorry, the beginning of '90, finishing up Harps and Hammers in London. So we were not in the studio recording for 5.5 years.
Wow, so you got together. Did you practice much before that, or?
Hell no.
You don't. Hey, when you're good, you don't have to.
Practicing's for losers.
Who needs that?
I know, that's pretty stupid. But we didn't have much time, so. But kind of it is, since you had, it would be different if we were just casual players with each other, but we had toured together.
Right.
So, I mean, when you've played 70 shows in Europe in front of lots of people, and winging it in certain things, you kind of can pull it together pretty quickly.
And that's also the sign of a very tight band. And that doesn't hurt anything, because when you could get a band together and practice and practice and practice, but if you don't have the synergy in that,
right.
It's just not going to work. So I like the fact that you guys did that live. That's
well, I bet you really we could do that right now. I bet you because of all the time we spent together. I bet you like if I had Bailey and Gilman and my brother together, I bet you we could actually start jamming out within like half an hour.
Maybe you could all go to Japan.
That would be cool.
That would be cool because they really are. There's a lot of bands that I've interviewed that have gone over there and had a lot of success. But did you guys ever play in Japan, or did you?
No,
just...
no. We did like the U.S. West Coast. We did like Italy, Greece, Germany, Belgium. We did a lot of Belgium. And we did in England, and we even played like a show in the west of Ireland. But we never got to go to the Japan at all.
Well, what was
your? I mean, we didn't play a lot in the States, other than say Los Angeles, up and down the coast in college towns like Santa Barbara, Santa Cruz, that kind of San Diego State University. But up and down, we did a lot of that.
Yeah, that's some pretty cool places there. But what was your favorite place to play in Europe during the tour? What was your the best gig that you remember?
You know, I think two places in Greece, actually. I liked Athens and Thessaloniki. Those shows were the way it would be if it was the 60s, because people knew the lyrics to the songs. Yeah, there was a lot of people there, too. I mean, it was, and we did TV interviews. We took over a radio station for a while. I mean, it was just sort of like, it was like, hey, we're the Monkees.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, you should have sang that one.
But it was completely different, like when coming, say, doing a club gig in Germany, where there's like 150 people there, and that's fine and all. But you're flying in, and you're met at the airport, and you're driven into town, and your posters are lining the streets, and you're put up in a nice, really nice hotel, and you don't have to do anything for a week other than party.
Yeah, that can't.
It's kind of different.
Yeah, that's not bad at all. That's kind of like... what the Rolling Stones have been doing for, what, 50 years or 40 years?
Yeah.
Yeah, they kind of are starting to look like it a little bit.
Yeah.
But, oh, my gosh. But
time cannot be on your side forever.
No, that's true, yeah. I could maybe come up with another one, but I'll let that go. But it's interesting to me, too, that what's happening now is, like, I'll play some of the Steps music to some of the younger people, and I've got some bands coming on. That there's a young band out of New Jersey, John, that's called the Striped Bananas, that are really into psychedelic music, and they are pretty young. And
right.
Then I'll say, listen to the Steps, you know, listen to this band, listen to that band, and they're just blown away, and they're like, oh wow, you know, that's really cool stuff. And I think that's what I like about, you know, how you and I can talk, and we can talk about the band, and we can share music, and then other people can share it. And that's one thing about the internet, and that has kind of changed things.
Because
you were talking about how back in the 80s you were knocking on doors, you were trying to get to the, you know, to the record company people. I mean, it was more of a physical thing. Now it's like you said, the guy in just contacted you from London. You know, and that would be pretty hard to do. I mean, it would be possible to do 20 or so years ago.
It's that now it's sort of like with the Facebook aspect, and you can just grab stuff off YouTube and put it to somebody and say, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? You can pull up goofy psychedelic stuff you may have never have heard, which I haven't heard, and somebody will put it on their page, and I'll go, oh, cool, I never heard that. And people go, you never heard that? Hey, I can't hear everything.
Yeah, that's true. Well, there's a lot out there, but it's really cool. My guest is John Fallon of The Steps. And this is part three of our interview series, and we're going to continue on with the interview. We're going to take a music break, and let's play The Time Goes By.
Okay.
And when we come back with the rest of the interview with John Fallon, we will talk about Time Goes By, and we will talk about the rest of the songs we have. And we just want to, you know, we thought it'd be kind of cool to talk about how the recordings went and that kind of stuff. So when we get back, we'll continue our interview with John Fallon, and this is Time Goes By but the Steps. So stick around, and we'll be right back.
Make you feel the way I do. Sunshine.
And we're back with John Fallon of The Steps. We just heard Time Goes By. And let's talk about that, John, about how that, when the recording process for that.
Okay, that one, that's from the Inquire Within album, which was recorded in 1988 after the first European tour. That was in London with our engineer, Mark Dawson, and that was at Goldust Studios. It was in Bromley. And that's really where a lot of it we hit our stride at this period, I think, where we had the right engineer, we had the right environment, the guy knew all the kind of music we liked. There was, you know, you wouldn't have to second guess stuff. You go, this kind of stuff. You know when Sonso had a sound? Yeah, I know that. You know Mark Boland? Yeah, I know that. You know, everybody knew everything at that point.
That's so cool.
And I had just bought a book called The Complete Beatles Recording Sessions by Mark Lewisohn. Came out in 1988. And before we went in the studio, I read that, and I caught something in regarding Rain, the way they did that. And besides the point where everybody knows, you know, the backwards part, blah, 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 but there was an interesting point. Is they recorded the basic tracks in a key and then dropped it to make it lower.
Wow.
So say, I think it might have been an A, or it was an A flat, and they dropped it into G. And the reason they did that is to make the drums seem kind of slow motion sounding. And if you listen to the way Ringo's playing, it's that there is sort of an odd, there's an odd feel to it. It's not quite right in a way. And I thought that was interesting. So what we did is, I had written Time Goes By in F. So what we did is we recorded the bass, the drums, and my initial rhythm guitar and recorded it in G. Then we slowed the tape down to F, the key that it's supposed to be in.
Wow.
And on that, I overdubbed the other, like, padding guitar, and then Tim did his leads on when it was in F. And I sang it when it was in F, too. But so it really, the song is in F, but I played it in G. And when I pick up the guitar to play it, I go, oh, crap, that's why it's really in F. Because I had to play it in G in order to record it a certain, you know, so we could slow it down and put it into F. And that's why the drum rolls go, do-do-do-do-do-do. You can't really play that slowly. Right. You know, it's just the way it was done. So you can hear the drums do sound a bit strange in there. And the bass is kind of almost liquidy. So there's a kind of a feeling of slow motion to it, which gives it kind of a druggy connotation.
You know, that's wild. And when you were reading the book about that, you know, when the Beatles were experimenting with that kind of – and that's interesting to me.
Rip off the best. That's what I say.
I wonder where they even came up with that idea. Was that George Martin doing those ideas, or did that come from the guy?
Well, it's funny, Martin was pretty good on this, where, I mean, that particular, like the backwards guitar thing that came in at the end of Rain, like, with Lennon's voice, that was an accident that Lennon did at home on his home recorder, and he brought the idea back into the studio. And in that same year, 66, they did I'm Only Sleeping.
Right.
There's, that's just strictly taking the tapes, turning them around, and playing your guitar normally to backwards recording. So we did that too. Actually, we did that a few years earlier on. Actually, if you do play the other song too later, it's Bigger Than Life.
Okay.
That one, I actually played the lead, and it's all backwards guitar. It's like super heavy Jimi Hendrix type, you know? Because Hendrix obviously picked up what the Beatles are doing, and he did the same thing.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. So when you went into the studio, that was on Inquire Within. So this is interesting to me because I think, John, this is what is missing a lot right now in music, is the having the guts to experiment and to try different things. And even if, like, you know, you look back and you say, oh, okay, the Beatles did it in 66.
Right.
But it was still kind of gutsy to do that kind of stuff.
Well, at the time we were going to do any of this in the late 80s, or even like when we did a little earlier in the 80s, really, there's nobody doing any of this sort of thing. So, yeah, in a way, people would go, you guys are 260s. And you go, but you know what? I'm living for me. I'm not living for everybody else. And if this is the kind of artistic music we want to make, that's what we're going to do as long as somebody's paying for it. And we had Greg Shaw at Box Bomb Records. And he's a total psychedelic head, and he was blown away by us. He kind of, you know, fairness, he indulged us, let's put it that way. Because you know what it was? He put us in the studio because he wanted to hear more cool albums.
And that's awesome. And so just talk about the rest of the album. I mean, when you did it out, what also were you thinking when you were putting this together? I mean, was there a certain goal with Inquire Within, or was it just like a creative music expression, or were you guys thinking this is what we want to obtain through this album?
Well, it was, okay, first it had the novelty that we were recording in London rather than in Hollywood. So
okay.
That was different. And it was sort of like, in a way, it was more businesslike in its own way, where you get up in the morning, you take the train to work, you make your lunch order, Mark in the studio would write everybody's sandwich order down, and it would be delivered. You know, it was sort of like working in an office, but much hipper. It was more structured, and it was all over at 5 or 6 or whatever in the evening. You know, so we'd be up in 8, get there by 10, and finish by 6, and do that like Monday through Friday, and then do a gig on the weekend. Where when we were in L.A., you're in L.A., you go into the recording studio at 8 at night, it's 3 in the morning. You know what I mean? There's a lot of that. And sometimes that is cool. But just like, when you did that two albums in a row already, it's good to do something a bit different. Because like part of the album studio, what we did was recorded in a bungalow in the center of Hollywood, where it's surrounded by parking lots. Even that was surreal. I mean, we're near Hollywood and Vine, and there's a little wooden bungalow house that's been converted into a recording studio. Nobody would know that. It was completely strange. And we'd get there at night and do our recording, and we'd leave at 2 or 3 in the morning.
Well, that's like totally opposite.
Everybody
of what
on Jolt Cola or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's just so different from what you guys were doing in London. But did you feel, which one did you like, or were they both okay? I mean, which did you like the more structured way, John, of recording, or the more like we'll do it?
I think I do think you go through phases. I mean, like if I had to go do it again, because I've had so many years that I haven't done it really, I would be open to any of it, right now. But, as a band at the time, I think it was still okay for us to be structured a bit by then, because we were really kind of, you don't want to sit around all day and get worn out in a strange town and then go start recording.
Right.
It's sort of like it was good to just get up and get out there. I mean, Tim didn't make it all the time. I remember we were doing one song, I think it was Panic Attack, and I did all the guitar work on the whole song. And it was like, well, I guess we didn't need Tim on that one. Then Tim walks in, and he goes, let me have a go. And we go, oh, sure, what the hell. He goes up and he puts this cool, super, like I could never play, outro on it. So it's sort of like, his laziness actually worked then. And I figured he'd get away with it. If I walked in late, I'd probably screw everything up.
Oh, that's funny. But it worked out. That's pretty cool. Well, why don't we play Bigger Than Life? And you talked a little bit about it.
I'll set this one up beforehand so people can actually listen to something. Listen
okay.
More, because in this song, Dave is this is one by Dave. He sings lead and I sing backing vocals. He plays Hofner Beetle bass. He plays the acoustic guitar. I play a Vox Teardrop lead for the backward stuff that sounds like kind of Jimi Hendrixy. And there's no drums on this, so Jim isn't playing. But Tim and Dave play the percussion. And the percussion, I probably can't hear it through this, but if you have the CD and you can listen to it, the percussion is a Schaefer beer can that's half full of Schaefer beer, hit with a recorder, like a flute, hit at the top end of the can, so you poof. And then the other sound is an empty guitar case that's thumped with your fist. And that's the percussion throughout the entire thing. Wow, man. It's funny, that whole song was recorded in a room that was about 6 foot by 4 foot wide. That one track. The rest was in the big rooms, but this actually could be contained in that small room. So it's almost like doing a home recording now, where you do it
right.
In a room.
Right.
So we were we did the first home recordings.
Yeah, that's good. Groundbreaking. Well, let's play it. Bigger Than Life, and my guest is John Fallon of the Steps, and we'll be right back after this song with the rest of the interview, so stick around. This is Bigger Than Life, the Steps. Thank you. Bigger Than Life, The Steps. My guest is John Fallon. Yeah, that's kind of cool knowing that that was a beer can.
Yeah, and it has to be a Schaefer. We tried a few other ones, and only the Schaefer worked. I mean, I'm not, this is sounds stupid, but we did. I actually tried like a Miller, and I think, or was it like Olympia? No, the Schaefer was the right one. So we had to drink all those beers to be sure.
Well, I was going to say, John, if you needed any help with that in the future, I could come over and drink beer.
I might need help these days, but back then we needed no help.
Oh, that's pretty wild. And it sounds pretty cool. It sounds really cool, and I think I would have never known that unless you would have set that up like that. It wouldn't have. But that's really awesome. So when you look back at your albums, which I think you were talking about, Inquire Within was one you felt like the band had hit its stride. Which one are you the most proud of right now when you look back at the albums of The Steps?
It's like I almost divide them up into phases. Like there's the initial phase when we were starting out, like we're rough and raw, where like it was the Blue Max stuff that we did, and then it goes into the Mystic one, which was which is really like 2-4 tracks, say EP slammed together, because we did 4 songs, like I said, with that guy Ron Fair, who later went on to produce was there Aguilera, something like big commercial junk or whatever, but he did 4 songs for us, and they were used as the 4 songs on the Mystic EP on the A side. Then the B side was done at Mystic Studios, which is funny, that is where Charles Manson had recorded
a
bit, and they told him to get up, go away. And also some demos were done there by Led Zeppelin for the Zeppelin 2.
Wow.
And I don't know whether they used some of the rhythm tracks there, but I know they were in there, and there's a plaque in that studio regarding Screaming Lord Sutch. He did an album called Screaming Lord Sutch and Friends, and Page and John Paul Jones are on that. That was that studio. I mean, it was a dump. I'm not saying it was a great place or anything, but it was just kind of odd. And that was the one I was telling you before. I think it has a speakeasy in the basement from the 20s.
Oh, okay.
And it was used as the sound, you know, where your echo chambers?
Yep.
And it still had the bar and some dusty chairs down there, and it was an echo chamber. So there is some odd vibes in that place. But, we were dealing with people that really didn't know how to record anything. So we did 4 songs for them, and that's the 4 songs in the B-side of the Mystic EP. It's patching it together as a cover, like green cover with some photos of us. You know, I mean, it was 1984 or whatever that came out, and you're on Mystic Records, which is a punk label. I mean, we didn't belong there in the slightest. But again, the guy, the Englishman that ran it, Doug Mooney, really liked us, and he just wanted to put something out. We run into that a lot. People that really like us want to put something out. They don't give a shit whether it sells or not. Because they want to hear some good music.
Oh, yeah. That's what I would do.
But, I mean, that was like the initial phase. Then there's the next phase when Greg Shaw signed us at Bomb Box Records. And that's like Drop of the Creature in studio. They were done with the same engineer, a guy named Brett Gurwitz, who was in the, I think he's a bass player or guitarist with Bad Religion.
Okay.
And again, not suited to our style of music, but he was hip to the trip. You know, I mean, he would, you know, take it all in, and it was fun to work with him. But, you know, he doesn't know how to do a lot of things. And, I mean, we weren't experienced enough either, but we lucked out a lot. Some of the stuff is really interesting, and you'd never be able to reproduce it. So, you know, sometimes inexperience isn't such a bad thing as long as there's enough talent in the room to pull it off. Then there's the next phase, which is going to London, which is the Inquire Within album and the Harps and Hammers album. Those are much better recorded. We could play them, those tracks alongside even my favorite bands, and I would still say it's recorded well. Now, you can listen to Pink Floyd, and you can listen to The Steps, and both of them are recorded fairly well at that point. No, I'm not saying we're as good as Pink Floyd or anything, but I'm just saying you can actually put The Steps on and compare it to The Who or Pink Floyd or The Beatles and The Stones, the people that we emulate and we really liked through the years. We kind of joined the club, in my eyes, at that point, simply because we're pretty damn good.
Well, I agree with that, and I think that it's also, you know, you were talking about the production value, but also, you know, a band, when you build confidence as a band and you start playing and you start thinking, you know, this is sounding pretty damn good, and you got to come to a point where you think that, you know, and I don't think that's wrong. I mean, I think that's good. I think it's good for a band to think that and to build on that confidence and to think, you know, we can do this,
right,
and we could come out sounding good.
Yeah, and also it keeps you on your toes. It's not so much like, I mean, maybe it doesn't with some other bands where they feel like they're, you know, people lose their way. We never lost our way in that. I mean, we we had a balance in our group. I mean, it should be pointed out that I wrote mostly half the songs, and David wrote mostly half the songs, and then Tim actually started writing the two tracks on every album too. So we were actually having our own little Beatle experience where we have a Lennon McCartney thing going on, which is a competition. Plus,
yep.
We have the George guy now who's actually really writing. Actually, it gets to be kind of funny, you know?
Yeah.
So, we were actually kind of living the dream, except, you know, we needed to get onto the next level, which would have been a major label. But, you know, it's funny enough, we ran out of gas as a band in that way around the time Oasis came along. So Oasis were able to kind of explode onto the scene fresh and younger. And we were still kind of, we're a lot more psychedelic than they are. But let's face it, we're all digging in the same revolver stream, you know?
Oh,
we're
yeah.
We're still going back to the hips, you know, like the period of, say, the early Who, the mid-period Beatles, like Revolver, and the Stones, Aftermath, all the way through, all the way through Exile on Main Street, because I still like the Stones and Mick Taylor. I like all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So that was the area we were exploring. It's just that we couldn't keep it together as four guys that live all over the place without being on a major label at that point. But you know, that phase of us was over. And then, strangely enough, I did a solo album with Mark Dawson, as the engineer, and that was still kind of going the same direction. It's just we weren't all together anymore. And, you know, everybody's getting pissed off that we're not getting anywhere at this point. So I just kind of did a solo album because there was something to do. But after that, we had like a few years of zero. That was done in 91. And then we got together in 95 to do the other album. But even then, you feel like, oh, we're all older now. I mean, really, it was, 4 years? But,
yeah.
You know, we did another album, so I don't know if I would have been good at doing this for a period after that, but coming into it now, I'm re-energized, actually, because of my son's group. Like, they make me more interested in doing stuff. And that's why I was kind of nagged into, why don't you do a single, why don't you do a single, why don't you do a single? So finally, I said, screw it, I will do a single. And, you know, I the single actually was recorded here at home, but actually it sounds pretty cool. And now the record company wants me to do like a 4-song EP for later in the year.
Oh, that's great.
So I'm hoping to do it with like some guys I know. Like I was telling you once before, this group called A Quarter After out of L.A. I'd like
right.
to record with Rob, the lead guitarist in that group, and maybe his brother Andy, and just do something, you know, different. And then, maybe one or two tracks, whatever, and then I'll do some others. But just to kind of energize me by playing with some other people.
Right.
I can't get the steps back together. I mean, I'm still in touch with everybody, and I would love to be playing with Jim on drums, no question. Because with Jim on drums, I don't have to think.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tim's a better guitar player than me anyway. I mean, I play more in a style like Lennon, or I bang away, say Townsend. You know, like, I don't play flowing, cute leads, and Tim does. He's got much more control. He controls, like, he plays a Fender Jaguar, and he controls it so much with the vibrato on it, and it makes it almost sound backwards when he's playing straight forward. No, he can actually control feedback to the point where he goes, wah, wah. And I'm like, I couldn't be bothered even having a vibrato on a guitar.
Are the other members of the Steps doing any recording at all, or any playing in any bands, or just you?
No, they're not really. I mean, I think Jim stays in shape, though, by playing drums on the weekend all the time with friends, like doing bar stuff, just because as a drummer you need to play.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's different. So, yeah, and really a year ago I wasn't doing anything either. It's just that all of a sudden I got the offer to do the single, and I wrote a song that Picture Yourself Today. I wrote that because I needed to put it on a single. So that was a brand new song. So those two songs that I did, like the other one, Theme for Steam, neither of those songs were old ones left around. I had to write them specifically for the single. So I just picked up an old Rickenbacker, and I've written 4 more songs.
Wow.
So you get inspired by doing certain things. I mean, sometimes it's physical. You're holding a guitar, you're playing it. And because you haven't held this guitar before, you come up with some other ideas. And also because of this, my son's group, Acton Town, they're going to have a single out probably about 4 weeks.
Oh,
on the same label. So once that takes off, then they'll be going back in to do another one. So this is a slow process, but it's going to be building. And I've checked out a guy in California that I liked his music, and I suggested him to the label. And his stuff, it's a group called Sugar Rush Railroad Incorporated.
Wow.
These guys have 2 crazy psychedelic songs. they're already ready to go. So they'll be coming along in the same label. The label is St. Albans Records out of Connecticut.
Okay.
And it's going to be kind of a hip label. Like, every release is going to be different and weird.
Well, that's cool.
So be warned.
You know, it was interesting when you were talking about motivation, because that's got to be a big thing. Because, you know, when you're in the band and things were going, you know, you were all together, and then you got, you know, separated, and then you said, you've done some solo stuff, and then you saw your son, and that motivated you, and that's kind of awesome, I think, how that motivation works like that. Because, you know, I'm really glad you're motivated and you're writing new music again, because I'm just, you know, excited to hear it. And I think that it's sometimes people do get to a point where they, you know, I don't know why, but, you know, they think, yeah, I don't know if I feel like writing music anymore. But
you have to have a reason. You have to be motivated, because as far as I can remember now, my last going into the studio to record an original tune was in the late 91. So really, from 91 up until now, I haven't recorded any new material. I recorded that cover version of the Oasis song,
right?
Rockin' Chair. I did that in, was it January 97? But that was just to have an extra track to put on a Rarities Step CD that came out in England. You know, it was just to have something different on it, so I just went in the studio with a guy and recorded. So I had a drummer, and I just played all the other instruments and sang it. But I picked that particular Oasis song because I thought, that's kind of, they were mining the same field as us, and here I'm going to prove it. You know, I went and recorded it. And, you know, it's funny. I'm not going to say it's better or worse. It's different. And I think it's different. It's more me. I could take their song and make it me.
Yeah, it's a great job on that. I love that song. That's a really cool song. And you did a great job.
Even the Times of London actually said, me recording that and putting it on that actually completely made sense. You know, putting the steps in the context of Oasis.
Yeah, I would agree.
So, I mean, that's pretty high praise. I mean, the Oasis were a very successful band, I mean, financially and artistically in the beginning. And then, but the Steps, I think, were artistically, we were constantly a good group artistically, but financially, I mean, you know, we didn't sell millions of records.
Well, John, we're running out of time. It's been great talking to you. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. What's the closing song that's coming?
The closing song, let's do Let Me Love You.
Okay, that's one that's sung by Dave, and, this is the one where Tim and I are dueling guitars here. It's like we're battling it out like we're in Abbey Road meets Thin Lizzy. And Tim's using his, of course, Fender Jaguar, and I'm using an Ovation Breadwinner on this. So it's like similar, our really good guitar work here. Dave's powerful vocal, and he's playing rhythm on guitar and bass on this. And, of course, Bailey's playing the drums.
Sounds good. Well, thank you so much, John, for being on, and we'll keep in touch. And my guest is John Fallon of The Steps, and we're going to go out tonight with Let Me Love You from The Steps. And, John, have a great evening, and the best of luck to you. And
you never know, we may do part four one day.
Hey, that's true. That's true. I'm up for it. Okay, well, thanks a lot, John. We'll talk to you later. Everybody have a great evening, and we'll talk to everybody later.
And don't forget, people, go out and buy the single. Picture yourself today and Theme for Steve McQueen by John Fallon.
There you go. Go out and buy it.
Brought to you by the makers of Diet Pepsi. Now move it along.
And buy two or three of them. We'll talk to you later, John. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye now.